Gracias por estar aquí y gracias, por supuesto, a la Asociación de Periodistas Europeos por organizar un año más este curso, por permitirnos estar todos aquí y por tener, en mi caso, el privilegio de moderar una mesa redonda que probablemente nos va a enseñar a todos mucho y vamos a además tener la suerte de tener unos espléndidos especialistas con nosotros, excepto uno de ellos, que me comunican, el señor Emilio Figueroa, que ha tenido un accidente y no va a poder estar con nosotros. Pero, en fin, creo que la mesa está muy bien ocupada y vamos a pasar probablemente unas horas muy interesantes hablando, según dice aquí, de reordenación estratégica de los blindados a la energía. Esto suena quizá un poco difícil de entender, pero creo que con un mínimo esquema vamos a saber perfectamente de qué estamos hablando. Estamos en este año en el aniversario, los 20 años de la caída del Muro de Berlín, que han sido 20 años claves para la historia de Europa. Han sido los años de la reunificación de Alemania, los años del final del sistema comunista, los años en los que la Unión Europea y también la Alianza Atlántica se han expandido hacia el este, las fronteras de Europa han crecido y se han situado prácticamente a las puertas de lo que antes fue la Unión Soviética y ahora Rusia. Esta expansión naturalmente ha producido una crisis de identidad y también en un primer momento una crisis de liderazgo por parte de Moscú, que se veía amenazado por esa expansión y que perdía un poco los papeles. Ahora parece que los está recuperando, pero todavía hay bastantes dudas sobre esta identidad y sobre todo sobre quién manda realmente en el Kremlin. Estos 20 años han sido también para Europa unos años muy buenos desde el punto de vista económico. Han sido años de crecimiento, han sido en España naturalmente los años del pelotazo, los años de la construcción. Todo iba muy bien hasta que llegó la crisis. Estos años de crecimiento económico, de expansión, han sido también los años en los que han ido aumentando las necesidades energéticas de todos los países de la Unión Europea y sobre todo de algunos de los más potentes de una manera extraordinariamente sensible. Este aumento de las necesidades energéticas iba unido naturalmente a un aumento de la dependencia de uno de los principales suministradores, en este caso de Rusia, y ahí es donde va el problema. Rusia se ha transformado prácticamente, como creo que comentábamos ya el año pasado, en un sistema de monocultivo, es decir, especializado en las exportaciones de gas y petróleo, y esto le hace tremendamente fuerte, pero al mismo tiempo también tremendamente dependiente de los clientes, y ahí ha llegado la crisis económica y lo complicó todo. ¿Qué se puede decir de todo esto? Pues que la Unión Europea ha crecido, pero no ha madurado. Se ha ampliado, pero no ha profundizado en sí misma, en hacer las instituciones más fuertes, más flexibles y más preparadas para los retos que han ido llegando. Se lanzó la Unión Europea, sobre todo, a poner el acento en la unión monetaria, en el euro, en buscar unas nuevas relaciones estratégicas con Estados Unidos y con Rusia, pero se olvidó de algo tan importante como es la energía. Eso ya lo mencionaba ayer el secretario de Estado para la Unión Europea. No tenemos un marco legal sobre el asunto de la energía en Europa. Cada país ha hecho lo que se le ha ocurrido. Solamente en el Tratado de Lisboa, en el artículo 4, se habla de que los Estados tienen justamente que, de alguna manera, coordinar sus necesidades energéticas, de hacerse también menos dependientes del exterior, comunicarse entre sí mismos, prestarse energía cuando sea necesario. Y este olvido de la energía en nuestro marco legal europeo era realmente paradójico cuando nuestra dependencia energética iba creciendo año y año. Estamos hablando ahora de entre un 70 y un 75% de necesidades energéticas. En el caso de España es un 80% lo que dependemos del exterior para poder encender en nuestras casas la luz y para que funcione el frigorífico, la calefacción, etcétera, etcétera. Y los problemas de esta carencia de una política energética común los estamos viendo en estos momentos. Los problemas constantes con Rusia, esa pasividad que hemos tenido frente a a la falta de la política energética común, la indefinición de las relaciones entre la Unión Soviética, entre la Unión Europea, perdón, y Rusia. Lo estamos viendo también en estos últimos años. No sabemos muy bien cómo tratar a Moscú y con quién. Hemos visto también que los rusos se han dotado a sí mismos de un arma política de enorme fuerza, como es el gigante Gazprom. Hemos visto también que algunos países europeos lo que han hecho ante esta situación de indefinición ha sido crear sus propios gigantes energéticos. Estoy hablando concretamente de Francia y de Alemania, que han creado el concepto de campeones nacionales de la energía. Algunos de esos campeones nacionales, por cierto, les acaban de castigar en Bruselas. Sin ir más lejos, la semana pasada, tanto a E.ON como a Gas de Francia les han puesto multas millonarias precisamente por aprovecharse en exceso de esta situación de privilegio energético. Y este continuo chantaje por parte de Rusia a la Unión Europea pues nos ha planteado también en estos momentos qué hacer para terminar con esta situación bastante problemática. Se ha reabierto, estamos en medio de un debate sobre si la energía nuclear podría ser la alternativa a esta dependencia. Estamos viendo también que con el cambio climático tenemos que buscar fórmulas que hagan posible lo que se llama crecimiento sostenible, es decir, hacer una economía que al mismo tiempo respete el medio ambiente y en el caso de los europeos nos facilite llegar a esos límites que nosotros mismos nos hemos fijado, es decir, reducir el 20% los niveles de contaminación a los niveles de 1990. Y por último, tenemos el reto de efectivamente, si se pone en marcha este Tratado de Lisboa, de cómo los gobiernos van a comprometerse para elaborar esa política energética común que nos hace tanta falta. Y ahí es donde está, desde mi punto de vista, la duda si alemanes y franceses van a estar en condiciones de renunciar a esos campeones nacionales que ya han constituido y también renunciar a esos acuerdos bilaterales que han estado firmando en los últimos años para conseguir al menos asegurarse sus suministros de gas y de petróleo. Esto es, digamos, el esquema básico de lo que creo que va a ser el debate de esta mañana. Y en él vamos a contar con estas especialistas, estas personas que tengo el privilegio de tener a mi lado y a las que inmediatamente voy a dar paso. Voy a empezar probablemente con uno de los investigadores que nos acompaña, Andrew Wilson. Él trabaja para el Consejo Europeo de Relaciones Exteriores de Londres. El Consejo Europeo es el primer think tank europeo que se ha creado. Es una organización que existe, la sede está en Londres, pero tienen sucursales en Madrid, en París, en Sofía, en Berlín. Ayer estuvo con nosotros Ulrike Geroth y hoy Andrew Wilson nos acompaña y va a ser la primera persona que nos ilumine en este aspecto energético.
Cuando quieras.
Gracias. ¿Y how long?
Yeah.
How long?
Well, 10 minutes. If you don't mind. I mean, let's start with 10 minutes.
Okay. I apologize for speaking neither in Spanish nor in Basque. I will try to speak English sufficiently clearly. As was said, I represent the European Council on Foreign Relations. We have just published a report, The Limits of Enlargement Light, European and Russian Power in the Troubled Neighbourhood. I have some copies, I've given some copies to Jaime here. Not enough for everybody in the room. You can also find it for free on our website, ecfr.eu, where there is also a small Spanish section organised by our Madrid office. So quickly, to summarise the report. It's mainly, of course, about the Eastern Partnership. By an accident of bureaucratic timing, this has emerged at a time when it is perceived by many in Eastern Europe
to be the EU's response to the economic crisis. It's not. It was conceived a year ago, before that crisis hit us, and is therefore designed to deal with very different things. Secondly, it overlaps with Russia's own increased ambition after the war in Georgia last August, and President Medvedev's stated attempt to create a Russian sphere of privileged interest in the same eastern neighbourhood. Now, we can argue about who moved first, whether the European Union's plan was accelerated in response to Russia's plan, but clearly there is a type of competition. But we argue it's a competition between very different visions and systems. Russia speaks openly of a sphere of influence in a 19th century kind of way. So that implies both a sphere, i.e. an exclusive area where only one power, Russia, can operate. The European Union does not seek to exclude other interested parties from the region in the same way. And secondly, Russia thinks in terms of influence. It thinks in terms of a hierarchy of powers. Sovereignty is only for the strong. Whereas the European Union's goal, through its partnership policy, we argue, should be more or less the exact opposite. The six states in Eastern Europe are all very weak and very crisis-prone. The European Union's fundamental policy should be to build up their sovereignty, not to exploit its weakness. Quickly, in terms of this competition, if you look at conventional indices of power, population, size of economy, military spending, the European Union far outguns Russia. But of course its problem is often converting that theoretical power into practical influence. The picture is not all bad. But if you look at comparable opinion polls taken in the Eastern neighbourhood, then the picture is very unlike the situation that existed for the accession countries in the early 90s, when more or less there was a national consensus on European destiny. For various reasons, the six countries are much more deeply split on whether their fundamental orientation should be towards Russia or the CIS, or whether it should be integration with Europe. The observant amongst you will note that often the figures sum to more than 100. Many people want to have it both ways, but this is precisely the point. There is no clear national consensus on a drive towards European destiny. But if this is a fundamental picture, there are some sides of reorientation towards Europe. If you look at the trade patterns of the six states, or five out of six trade now more with the European Union than with Russia on both exports and imports. With Belarus, it exports more to the EU, but it imports more than Russia. So in only one relationship out of 12 does Russia come out ahead. But if you look at other indices, the picture is very different. This table shows labour migration. Now, the EU's willingness to accept labour migrants is much less than that of Russia, which has no visas and an open-door policy. And apart from Moldova and West Ukraine, the figures for Ukraine aren't disaggregated, but Ukraine is very regionally split. People from West Ukraine head west, people from East Ukraine head east and north to Russia. Much larger numbers go to Russia than go to the EU. And as a consequence, the money that those migrants send back has become a factor, first of all, underpinning the stability and prosperity of the neighbourhood economies, and now, with that process going into reverse, threatening that stability. Our report looks at various types of hard and soft power. Now, if this therefore should form a kind of clear quadrant, four sections, soft power influence exercised by the EU, soft power influence exercised by Russia. But on hard power, the box for the EU is pretty empty, although we put some things in. The EU isn't really about hard power and doesn't do it very well. But even on some of its specialisms, soft power, the EU is being outplayed and outfought. Labour migration is one. Another key factor is mass media. For several reasons, one of which is cultural legacy and the residual importance of the Russian language. Russian media is dominant throughout the region. But there are other reasons for that dominance. One is that Russia is very successful at exploiting the opportunities of new media, internet, blogging, and so on and so forth, where local markets overwhelmingly tend to go through Moscow to access the wider world. So in many cases, the situation is commensurate. Russia does the same things as the EU does, and does them better, labour migration being the best example. In other areas, though, just as with Russia's sphere of influence approach being very different to the European Union sovereignty building approach, Russia operates very differently in the type of economic investments it makes, where it targets strategic assets and energy assets in particular, in the way it influences local politics. The EU on the whole tries to support pluralist democracy, whereas Russia operates via this very particular local term of political technology. One thing that has been unnoticed largely in the West is that the way that Russia reacted to its setback, the setback to its power and influence that was the Orange Revolution in Ukraine in 2004. It sat down and thought about how to copy what it saw as the West's key strategic modes of influence, in particular the operation of NGOs, and in the last three years has set up its own very extensive network of Russia-friendly NGOs and small parties throughout the region. Ironically, therefore, Russia has more influence in the relatively open states, Ukraine and Moldova, whereas in countries like Belarus and Azerbaijan, with their more closed politics, Russia finds it as difficult to operate as sometimes we do in the West. So what should the European do? Well, firstly, it should recognise the reality of competition in the neighbourhood. And it should tabulate which of its levers are effective and which are not. It should look where it is being, where Russia is exercising more decisive influence and respond accordingly. And it should also recognise the reality of the nature of the local states. These are not the acquis-absorbing Weberian states of the 1990s. They are simply not strong enough. We argue that accession politics should not govern all. Even Ukraine, even Moldova are nowhere near accession and should be concentrating on practical policies to avoid crises and build up sovereignty before accession can even be talked of as a priority. They are, moreover, prone to three types of crisis, not just the economic crisis that we hear so much of. This has hit the region particularly hard, but it has hit the region hard because of these other two previous existing crises, the weakness of existing states and the ability and willingness of Russia to exploit that weakness. Finally, there is a particular type of behaviour which we refer to as collective Titoism. In the 1990s, the expansion model was very much supply-led. The European Union offered the would-be new member states the acquis communautaire. There was debate about how quickly to proceed in its adoption, but that was all. Whereas in the new Eastern neighbourhood, the EU is often the object of this collective Titoism, not the subject. The leaderships of the six states play this balancing game between Russia and the EU, precisely because they are weak and because they need resources, and they often extract them from both sides with considerable skill. A quick final word about policy. How should the EU respond? How should it play the game of influence better? Firstly, the kind of 1990s model of the unnegotiated export of the acquis communautaire does not work in the region. The EU has reached the limits of its transformative power. So its policy needs to be less supply side and more sensitive to local demand. We advocate in particular a listening tour of the region led by the Swedish presidency in the second half of this year. Its priority should be to build up the statehood of weak states. It should resist not a Russian presence, but a Russian sphere of influence, in the sense that I defined at the beginning, that it tends to exclude other powers and impose the sovereignty of the strong over the weak. But the EU also needs to work harder. It needs to improve its attractiveness, and we list a whole set of policies such as funds for new media, policies to attract particular groups, particularly students, to the EU, even the possibility of setting up a East European university, probably in Kiev, on the same lines as the Central European University in Budapest. And one last quick word. Why should any of this matter to Spain? Well, solidarity and the overall strength of the EU is a collective interest. Solidarity is a reciprocal project. Eastern Europe may be a long way away, but when Spain wants help with its problems in the south, obviously that's reciprocal to projects in the east. Spain is well positioned to know that borders are highly permeable, that a fortress Europe policy on its own does not necessarily work. Migrants, illegal immigration, crime crosses borders very easily, and in fact a policy of regulated pendular migration back and forth is often better than a fortress policy that tries to stop all movement. And thirdly, Spain may be a long way from Eastern Europe, but the spillover effects will always be felt even here. And I'll finish with one example. If there is a gas crisis in Ukraine again this summer, then Spain will be directly affected by a spike in the price of LNG gas. I'll stop there.
Bueno, con esta perspectiva tan amenazadora, no sé si vamos a tener muchas razones para el optimismo. En todo caso, podemos quizá tener otro contrapunto en otro investigador que está hoy con nosotros, de otro think tank español, pero con mucha presencia internacional. En este caso es John Sponstra. Él está especializado en el programa de democratización, y probablemente justamente democratización es lo que hace falta en estos países vecinos del área de influencia soviética, porque supongo que a más democratización, más posibilidades de crecimiento económico y más seguridad para toda la zona.
Gracias. 10 minutes, and after, just stop me when I go on too long. My name is Jos Boonstra. I work, as you heard, for a think tank that shares an office with ECFR, the speaker, Mr. Andrew Wilson, to which you have just listened. When I looked at this program and the prospectus of this program, there were, for this session, two main questions. And as a start, I would like to first try and answer these. The first was, is Russia's restoration of power a challenge for the European project? I think the answer can very simply be yes, it is. And Russia plays a very smart game of trying to ignore the European Union and try to work on a bilateral basis with Germany, with France, with Spain, and so on. So it is an enormous challenge for the European project. The second question, are we about to witness a new Cold War? There the answer I would say is no. But the times of integration of the European Union and expansion of NATO, those days seem to be over, and we need to tackle a lot of issues with Russia. Energy is maybe the foremost one. I would like to discuss a few main players and then a few regions and end up with a few rather grim conclusions. First, very briefly about the EU and NATO enlargement. EU enlargement has been, I think, a very positive process. We could not imagine 20 years ago that we would be living in one union with Poland, with Slovakia, with all these countries that have joined the European Union. I think this has been a remarkable process, but it has stopped for the moment. Yes, Southeast European countries will join at one point, but the process is rather slow. And the big issue at this point is Turkey, of course, because there is a lot of resentment in a lot of EU member states trying to incorporate such a big country, plus, of course, the questions of Islam. So, next to the Turkish issue, there is also, of course, Russia, which also tries to block further EU enlargement, and even more so NATO enlargement, also a positive process. This whole process of enlargement was coordinated quite well, I think. The EU mostly looked at the economy, at democracy, and so on, to try to push through reforms in these countries, that these countries could implement the whole acquis communautaire of 31 chapters. While NATO was more looking at defense reform, but also at democratization, about democratization of armed forces, about civil-military relations, and so on. So this was a sort of parallel process. NATO enlargement now has two issues, and that's Georgia and Ukraine. And there, often NATO is quite unified and can decide with consensus, but I think over the question of Georgia and Ukraine, also NATO itself is divided. First of all, we should recognize that Ukraine, more than half of the population, is not interested in NATO membership, so why push it? Georgia has another problem. 90% of the population is in favor of NATO membership, but it has two disputed areas, two war went on there, and it will be difficult for NATO to incorporate a country like Georgia and thus incorporate these frozen conflict areas. But also within NATO there are differences. For instance, I think you can see three different groups. First, there is a group maybe led by the United States that says for NATO enlargement we have to think strategically, and Ukraine and Georgia are strategically important. Important gas and oil pipelines go through Ukraine, as we just heard already, and Georgia is also a crucial transport country for energy from Azerbaijan and beyond the Caspian Sea. So they say, the United States, sometimes also the UK, let's try to incorporate these countries quickly, and then democratization, and to make sure that these countries fulfill all the criteria, this will come later. We have to think strategically. And another group of countries says, no, we first want to have more proof of democratic reform and consolidation. These are often North European countries, such as Germany, Netherlands, especially the Scandinavian countries. And then a third group of countries doesn't care that much up till now. And I hope this will change, because sovereign members of the European Union should step up and form an opinion about these regions that are quite crucial, I believe, also for Spain, for Portugal, for Italy, and so on. So that's EU and NATO enlargement. Another organization that I would like to highlight is the OECD. I suppose you are all well aware of the OECD and its work, since Spain was chairing this organization in 2007. But the OECD is an organization that tries to combine economy, security, and a sort of human dimension, democracy, human rights, all together as a way to approach it in a comprehensive way, the security issues in Europe. But it's an organization in trouble, and the main trouble started in 1999 when Russia decided that it was giving up on the OECD. Russia had hoped that the OECD would develop into a sort of NATO of which it would be a member itself. But this did not happen. Russia was very disappointed, first of all, with the NATO bombardments on Serbia in 1999. And secondly, it felt shamed by the documents in Istanbul it signed itself on arms limitations and withdrawing troops from Moldova, from Georgia, and so on. So Russia at the moment, and has been for the last 3-4 years, has had three problems with the OECD. The first one is the human dimension. Russia argues that this human dimension takes too much attention. It should be about security, the political security dimension, not the human dimension where the focus should be. Why is this? Russia has seen the revolutions in Georgia, in Ukraine, even an attempt to a sort of likewise revolution in Kyrgyzstan. And it feels that one of the reasons that these revolutions take place is OECD election monitoring. The OECD sends election monitors from Spain, from Finland, from everywhere to this country where the elections are, and then the next day a report comes out and it says these elections were fair or these elections were not fair. And then revolutions start within a day. And this is something that Russia feared. And it's true that the OECD institutions are quite independent in making these assessments. So this is one problem for Russia, too much attention for the human dimension. The second point of criticism in the OECD, and often the Russians have strong points, is that all attention in the OECD goes east of Vienna. Where are the missions of the OECD? They are in Georgia, in Tajikistan, in Ukraine, in the Balkans especially. But there are no missions, for instance, in Spain. There are no missions in Ireland, argues Russia.
In the Basque country.
Yes. Ireland. There are many cases where Russia says these are likewise the cases in Moldova. I think, personally, that this point doesn't make that much sense, because the development of the human dimension, the democracy credentials, are much stronger in the West. And how can an organization that is so ill-funded as the OECD also start these missions here? But in election monitoring, the Russians might have a point, and we should look at assistance in election monitoring also in Western countries. So this is a second point of criticism. And a third point is the institutional setup of the OSCE. As I just said, all these organizations in the OSCE, so the organization in Warsaw that arranges the election monitoring, an organization in The Hague that looks after media freedom and so on, and all the missions in all these countries that focus on democracy programs, on defense reform programs, on economic development programs. These are quite independent, and this is also something that Russia has problems with, because it's in their sphere of influence that these institutions act. And Russia would like to see that more is decided by the ambassadors and the council in Vienna through consensus. Imagine that elections are held in Kazakhstan, and that people from the OSCE draft a report if these elections were fair and if all rules were met. And that before the report goes out, first this report has to be judged and decided on and agreed on by all the council members in Vienna. It will take probably 4 or 5 months before such a report will come out, and it wouldn't make any sense anymore. So this is what I wanted to say about the OSCE. And I hope that some of you have questions and suggestions on how to move further with the OSCE, because it is quite a problematic issue. We saw the war in Georgia. War is not over in Europe. And the OSCE failed there because early warning is one of their main key points, and they didn't see it coming. And now we are in a situation that the OSCE even has to leave Georgia because Russia is vetoing a new extension of the mandate of the mission in Georgia. Well, this whole idea of comprehensive security today is so important. And Russia tries constantly to say we need a new format to discuss important security issues. So why not try to reform the OSCE in such a way that it can meet these questions? A few words about Russia itself. It has gone its own way, and rightfully so, but the word sovereign democracy that you might have heard and that has been pushed by the Kremlin is, I think, a bad quotation, because Russia has gone its own way. It is not a complete authoritarian regime, but it is certainly not a democracy, because the two main facets of a democracy is accountability and transparency, and those two things are missing. There is no one in Russia who can hold the government accountable. The parliament cannot do so. Civil society can also not do so. Moreover, it's also not transparent how government decisions are made in Russia. So in that sense, I believe that Russia at this point is not a democracy. It has done well through oil and gas wealth, definitely. But this is stable. The economic crisis hits Russia rather hard. We now see that Russia has not really developed a strong middle-income class. So that means that the society is still divided in rich and poor. So how stable is the wealth acquired through oil and gas? But the third point, yes, it's true that Russia remains an important security player, especially because the European Union is so weak and NATO is occupied elsewhere, in Afghanistan. We saw in Georgia what happened there. Russia acted, and if in Central Asia something happens, Russia will also act. The EU at this point is even not capable of slamming down its fist on the table and going in quickly to restore stability and peace. So the security role of Russia is important, and that's why it's also important we cooperate with Russia. About the regions, very quickly. To be honest, I'm quite concerned after the war in Georgia and also after the sort of attempt of a revolution in Moldova 2 months ago, we cannot rule out war in Europe. Neither can we rule out new democratic revolutions or flower revolutions, however you want to call it. This is a concern for Russia, but also a concern for the European Union. I believe in Moldova, for instance, what we saw there is that there is a large group of young people that are European Union orientated or Western orientated. They don't have any opportunities in Moldova, and they are tired with a communist government for about 8 years now. This communist government has ruled. They don't have any perspective there, and this might be a source of tension in the future, because in all these former Soviet countries, the old bureaucrats that were important in the Soviet Union, these people are aging quickly now, and they need to be replaced, and they can be replaced by 2 sorts of people. People that are Western-orientated, such as in Moldova, or by technocrats, and those we already see a lot, especially young people that, for instance, in Azerbaijan, a country that has an enormous wealth in oil and gas, people that rise quickly to power and don't have any ideology anymore. And they are not pro-Russian or pro-Western or in that sense. For them, it's about business. So I foresee that there might be more instability. We saw this in Abkhazia, South Ossetia. These two issues will remain extremely difficult, and the EU will have a tough task in forming one opinion how to negotiate with Russia and how to make Russia keep the agreements that it signed in August last year. Briefly, a few words about Transnistria in Moldova. This is quite an interesting issue because of the 4 frozen conflicts, that is the one that most people say is most easy to solve. It's not an ethnic problem, it's mostly an economic problem. There is no hatred between Moldovans that speak Romanian and Ukrainians and Russians that live in Transnistria and in Moldova proper. It is a fight for influence in this sense between Russia and, at the moment we could almost say Romania, but the European Union and its interest. It is an absurd situation that you have a small strip of land of 600,000 people that have their own state, which is of course not democratic, where if you go to Transnistria, you see in front of the Supreme Soviet, which is the name of the parliament in Transnistria, you see a statue of Lenin. And when I was there and I spoke to the security minister of Transnistria and I asked him, why do the Russian troops not leave, as was promised earlier in 1999 through OSCE agreements? And the answer was quite interesting. He said there are different reasons why Russian troops are not leaving. The first reason is you should understand that this is Russian soil. The Russians have been here for hundreds of years and they have the right to be here. The second reason is the Transnistrian people have spoken out in several referendas for the Russian troops to stay here. The third reason is that the agreements in the OSCE are of a political nature, not of a juridical nature, so Russia is not obliged to keep to this agreement. And the fourth reason, he said, how can Russia feel obliged to keep to an agreement that was signed in drunkenness, because it was Yeltsin that signed the agreement in 1999. But still I have good hope that this might change. Another very tense situation, I believe, is Nagorno-Karabakh. And in this sense, Russia does not play a very big role, neither does the European Union. This is a fight between 2 newly independent states, between Armenia and Azerbaijan. There is some perspective to solve this. Armenia has won that war. Nagorno-Karabakh is de facto independent. It is reasonably functioning. And Armenia has this bargaining chip. 7 provinces that are completely deserted, but they are Azeri provinces, but under Armenian control. Surely a deal at one point can be made. On the other hand, Armenia is poor, although it has won that war. Azerbaijan is very rich at the moment through oil and gas. Can even be said, at one point, the Azeri president said, our goal is to have a defense budget that equals the state budget of Armenia, and they did so last year. So there must be some solution possible, some negotiation possible. But on the other hand, people are killed there almost on a monthly basis. People are shot at the border. Armenian soldiers defect to Azerbaijan and vice versa. You could think of a situation that more and more incidents happen and tension mounts between Armenia and Azerbaijan, which will be extremely difficult situation because Russia will support Armenia. It has always done so. On the other hand, Turkey might support Azerbaijan. They are also very close. That could even bring NATO in, since Turkey is a NATO member. It is quite a tense situation. do I have some time to tell a little bit about Central Asia? I understand that the attention here today is mostly about where Russia, the region where Russia and the European Union meet. Eastern Europe, we heard about the new Eastern partnership of the European Union, about Russia's intention. But there is another region which I think is also of great importance nowadays, and that's Central Asia. 5 former Soviet republics, and there are a lot of different interests there. Some call it the new great game. The original great game was played between England and Russia in the end of the 19th century, when both tried to colonize Central Asia. To be honest, I don't see a great game now. It's true, China has a lot of interest in these 5 countries, the European Union has a bit of interest, the United States, Iran, but to be honest, I don't think there is a new great game for energy yet there. It's Russia that is the main actor in that region. To give a few examples why Russia finds it so, or 2 points why Russia finds it so important, this region. The first is, a lot of the gas that is transported to the European Union through Russian pipelines is not Russian gas, it's Central Asian gas. It comes from Turkmenistan, sometimes from Kazakhstan. The Russians buy quite cheaply gas and resell it to Europe because they have the network of pipelines. So this is an enormous asset for Russia that it... Russia is not only an oil and gas producer, but also a transit country, and it makes a lot of money on this. The second reason is stability and security. In Europe, we are now very concerned with Afghanistan, and all our focus is on Afghanistan and the NATO mission there. And now there is this extra concern in Pakistan that is very unstable. The Russians do not want to see NATO fail in Afghanistan, but for them, there is another priority, and that is Central Asia, because many of the Central Asian countries border on Afghanistan. And if there is instability in these countries, that would be a third problem. It would be an extra direct problem for Russia, because it will be the only country that can directly act. So NATO would also be well advised, and the European Union, to not only think about military bases in Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Kyrgyzstan, but to also try to put more effort in working with these countries and really trying to build stability. It is not so easy, because these countries are not stable. The first reason why they are not stable is because they are ruled in a very autocratic way. All 5 countries have presidents for life, and in some cases, Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, these countries are ruled in a way that's in the same category as North Korea. Some countries like Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan are extremely poor, and they are development countries, and they are also not stable and also ruled in an autocratic way in which the regime has a lot of security forces, there is no freedom, and there is a lot of resentment among the population. Quite an unstable situation. The best of the five in that sense is Kazakhstan, also autocratically ruled, but the European Union can do work quite well with Kazakhstan. So this is one source of instability. Then there is radical Islam. And this is a problem that these leaders from these countries constantly use as an argument to keep a strong leadership, because they have to fight international terrorism and Islam. Well, often if you, for instance, look at Tajikistan, you see a situation where it's more the government that is pushing so hard that people become radical, because Tajikistan is a Islamic country by heritage, and they have their own rather mild Islamic traditions. So also there, it's important to give attention to. Another issue of instability in that region is the bad relations between the five countries. So it's not only interests of Russia, China, Iran, and the European Union and US that might create problems, Afghanistan and radicalism that might create problems, but also the relations among themselves. Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, and Kazakhstan have enormous wealth in oil and gas. Turkmenistan mostly gas, Kazakhstan mostly oil. The other two countries in the south that are more mountainous countries don't have any gas or oil, but they have water. And the three northern countries don't have water. And this creates a lot of tensions. At the moment, Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan are not able to produce enough electricity because they don't have the capacity through water to produce it. So they are planning to build big dams in the river. In that sense, they could then control the water, and the water would not freely flow anymore to Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan, who need that water for their cotton fields. And this creates an enormous tension between these countries. And this is another source of instability. Maybe we can talk further in the discussion about this. I think it is a region that should not be overlooked and is different from the Southern Caucasus and Eastern Europe, but also there we need to be careful that no new Berlin walls are built. Just a few conclusions, if I may. It's not really a rosy picture 20 years after the Berlin Wall fell. I don't believe that there will be grand new security mechanisms. I do not believe that one NATO member will want to give up NATO. It will be for NATO members the main security actor. Still, we need to find and accommodate some way of talking in a regional format with Russia. This might be the OSCE, but then it needs to be reformed. One way I could think of is to give up the idea of comprehensive security and split the EU or the OSCE in two parts. One is the human dimension part, with all its democracy and human rights agreements that should remain valid. The other part is the original idea of the OSCE, is getting the countries that were facing each other during the Cold War around the table again and just try to come to agreement and discuss security issues. We also need, I think, NATO and the European Union need to take seriously the organizations, the regional organizations that Russia is leading and member of. So there is CSTO, which is the Russian counterpart of NATO. There is the CES, which is the Commonwealth of Independent States, also mostly led by Russia. and the SCO, which is an organization between China and Russia and Central Asian countries. These are regional organizations that might gain importance and that need to be taken seriously. As a last point, I do think that we should not underestimate the chances of new conflict. I think the Georgia war was a rude awakening for us. After these prosperous years of EU enlargement and NATO enlargement and reasonably good relations until 2000 with Russia, we still cannot exclude conflict. And then most risky areas remain, of course, Georgia, which is still an extremely tense situation, but also Nagorno-Karabakh between Armenia and Azerbaijan, or even Central Asia, be it of internal instability or among the countries in the region or as a sort of spillover effect from Afghanistan. In that sense, we have a lot of work to do even 20 years after the wall fell. Thank you.
Muchísimas gracias. Después de estas dos excelentes ponencias que demuestran lo difícil que es combinar política, economía, geografía y geoestrategia, vamos a dar paso a Pablo García Verdoy para darnos el punto de vista diplomático. Él ha sido embajador español en Bucarest, es decir, muy próxima a la frontera rusa y a esta zona del Cáucaso, y probablemente nos puede dar una impresión de primera mano de lo que vivió allí y sobre todo de la perspectiva también de la diplomacia española con respecto a esta región tan lejana y, como acabamos de ver, sin embargo, desde el punto de vista estratégico, tan fundamental para los próximos años.
Muchas gracias, Aurora. Bueno, en realidad lo que más aporta en este debate es quizá que he sido embajador en Moldavia también, porque es una representación múltiple ante Bucarest y Chisinau. Bueno, yo quiero decir ante todo que lo que voy a decir es responsabilidad mía, porque entre otras cosas ya soy diplomático en excedencia como José María y hablo a título completamente personal y espero que un poco heterodoxo. Bueno, mi intervención quería centrarla en un título un poco provocador y es este: Transnistria y el pollo congelado, que luego explicaré a qué viene. Lo primero de todo, antes de comenzar, las intervenciones previas evidentemente representan unos enfoques muy fundamentados que parten de una visión, por decirlo así, muy completa y con un acento, desde mi punto de vista, metternichiano de lo que es la política exterior en Europa, ¿no? Yo vengo de un mundo mucho más de taller, mucho más de garaje, el mundo de la Unión Europea, y a mí me sigue pareciendo más convincente la explicación en el contexto europeo que nos dio nuestro padre fundador, si me permitís la expresión, Jean Monnet. En ese sentido, mi enfoque va a ser profundamente comunitario, ¿no? Lo primero de todo es que hay que tener una perspectiva de una cierta distancia, ¿no? La ampliación de la Unión Europea fue o no fue percibida como una amenaza para aquellos que se quedaban fuera de acuerdo con el calendario y con el sentido común. Por un lado, era crear un modelo geográficamente más amplio, distinto al que imperaba incluso en las zonas donde se amplió la Unión. Por otro lado, se decía, y dijimos todos, que era una oportunidad para establecer una nueva relación con aquella Europa que no estaba dentro. La realidad es que, tanto desde el punto de vista institucional como legislativo, nos encontramos con una confrontación, al menos material, ¿no? Enfoques diferentes, un mercado interior de tendencia expansiva y unas reglas distintas a las que habían imperado en el antiguo cordón sanitario. Por tanto, podemos afirmar que la ampliación supone la expansión de un modelo político-económico a lugares donde no existía y frente a lugares donde aún no existe, institucionalmente, desde el punto de vista de funcionamiento del Estado de Derecho y de la economía de mercado. Se trata, sin embargo, no solo de un conflicto transnacional, sino un conflicto también de carácter interno. No hay que olvidar que los grupos de intereses, exactamente igual que más allá de la línea de la ampliación, trabajan también en contra de los principios fundamentales del derecho comunitario. También vemos la tensión entre una economía abierta y una economía controlada, la defensa del interés nacional, legítimo o no, dentro de la Unión Europea. Es decir, ese debate no es solo un debate transnacional, sino que es también un debate interno. Ahora bien, reconociendo que existe un conflicto, y aquí voy a utilizar en mi exposición más bien el telescopio que el microscopio, entre dos modelos distintos, entre un modelo excomunista o comunista reconvertido, oligárquico, de debilidad institucional, frente a economías más abiertas, con instituciones más sólidas, con libertad de prensa, etcétera, no creo que debamos dar el paso para admitir que se trata de un conflicto entre bloques. Y lo digo así porque creo que la intervención de la globalización ha dado paso a una tupida red de intereses que son intereses que transversales y que en muchos casos crean una red de intereses compartidos más allá del concepto tradicional del bloque. En suma, estamos ante una taxonomía mucho más compleja que no permite una configuración de bloques tan homogénea como podía ser en otras épocas de la historia. ¿Cuál es el papel de la Unión Europea en la gestión de esta complejidad, ¿no? En primer lugar, yo me atrevo a sugerir, quizá para debatir después, una idea.